You've probably heard that Donald Trump is having a very interesting case before the Supreme Court, and that case is highly consequential for basically everything that pertains to his legal issues, save the New York matter. What is going on with Trump? Why is it so important, and what is likely to happen? Daniel R. Street is here to converse with me tonight. I am Joseph Cotto, and this is NewsSight. Good evening, everyone. Daniel, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, glad to be here. Good to be with you again. And sooner or later we'll run out of things to talk about with respect to Trump lawfare, but just not quite.
I doubt it because there's always new stuff, unfortunately, crawling up out of the woodwork. But before we get into this fascinating matter, please share with the audience who you are, what you do, and why you're qualified to opine on this very, very important Donald Trump related issue.
Well, thank you. Well, I'm an attorney. I've got 27 and a half years of legal practice, experience in legal practice in state and federal court. I'm also a legal analyst. I'm an author. I've written four books. And I've followed a lot of the president's, the lawfare being waged against the president and written about it. I will tell you that this particular issue, the issue we're here to talk about tonight, which is the presidential immunity issue, has never been litigated before in the history of this country. So anybody that studies it, there's literally no one person anywhere that's an expert on it. And so we're all learning what presidential immunity is and what it might be and how it might be resolved by the courts literally in real time. So it's exciting to talk about as an attorney. We just don't usually get the opportunity as lawyers to talk about things that no court anywhere has ever ruled on, particularly a constitutional issue like this. So it's really exciting to talk about. It's unfortunate that it's happening, but I've researched it extensively and I feel confident that I can prognosticate and read the tea leaves and see what and forecast, if you will, what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Your legal analyses are outstanding. And it's worth noting that you are not, just a lawyer like someone who works at a think tank or teaches at a university spouting theory. You are actually a trial lawyer who deals with courtrooms, with judges, obviously with defendants or plaintiffs. So it's your experience here is very practical, which is so unlike a lot of people who we see on television opining about A, B, or C, and of course, they quite often wind up being wrong in their prognostications.
Well, you're right. I have to tell you, anybody can be wrong. But what you see a lot, particularly on the more leftist news outlets, CNN, MSNBC, is people who are a lot of times legal analysts that are really just spreading propaganda and misinformation. And that's happened a lot over the years, but it's been on blast during the Trump era. And some of these people were very, very well respected in the past. Chief among them, the one that comes to mind is Professor Larry Tribe, who's just, was one of the most preeminent constitutional scholars in the country. And in the era of Trump, has just beclowned himself. It's really unfortunate. I read his law review articles when I was in law school, and then you see the guy now, and he's just a caricature of his former self. So, anytime people are trying to guess or forecast or prognosticate about what a court's going to do, obviously, there's chance, there's risk. People could be wrong. I could be wrong. I've been wrong in the past. I tell anybody that. But it's important to call it like you see it, call balls and strikes, and not be overtly an activist. And that's what's happened too often with legal analysts today, particularly in fake news media.
Oh, for sure. It's a terrible problem. It only looks to get worse. I think that, I mean, there's so many things to get into here, but I think that the average network or publication, whatever, brings on a lawyer who's likely to promote the agenda rather than deliver reasoned analysis, because the agenda is what gets clicks and it's what builds brand loyalty, essentially. And we live in the subscriber model today of media consumption, so brand loyalty is of utmost importance. Unfortunately, that means the facts do suffer on no shortage of occasions. Someone else, I'll just bring some before we get to your article, which was published on Substack, by the way. I'll let people know where they can find it. But something else worth noting is Luttig, Michael Luttig. He might pronounce his name differently. I don't really care. But he is someone who is a very respected conservative jurist, a former federal judge. And he was the chief proponent of the whole Trump disqualified because he committed insurrection argument, which the Supreme Court slapped down 9-0, uniting obviously the conservative and progressive wings. And Luttig is someone talked about who'd be clowned himself. He was the foremost so-called intellectual promoting this thing, and he predicted boldly that the court would go along with his opinion. I think, don't quote me on this, but I think he said it might even be 9-0 in his favor. I think he might have said that. But he did certainly say that the court would validate his point of view. You know, the precise opposite happened, and people took this guy so damn seriously. He was everywhere on these cable news shows, obviously featured heavily on social media. And there's no professional consequences for people when they're this wrong about something so important. He's a bit quieter lately, but he's still dragged out as this quote-unquote expert who, you know, really should have been able, particularly as a former federal judge, he should have been able to see what the hell was going on here. But obviously his hatred of Trump blinded him. I don't think he did it for money. I think he did it because his hatred of Trump blinded him. He's getting a lot of attention for his anti-Trump views. So I think he was sincere in his analysis, but I think his analysis was deranged and most certainly motivated by adulation from the usual suspects.
Yeah, well, that Colorado disqualification case was in, and that entire effort to disqualify President Trump under the Article 3 or Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was an abomination. And I covered that from the very beginning. I know that you and I talked about that, how anybody with a law degree could have gotten that wrong is beyond me. But then they got four justices on the Colorado Supreme Court to literally turn the law upside down and on its head. And that's exactly what they did. Where I think people went astray, where the leftist and anti-Trump, never Trump legal analysts went wrong, is they thought that the United States Supreme Court would be as deranged as they are and as some other courts have been, and they were wrong. And anybody with a brain and a law degree could see that. Some of this is just beyond, it's unfathomable. I can't even wrap my mind around how anybody came to a different conclusion. So that Colorado disqualification in the 14th Amendment issue was just insanity. It was crazy. It was contrary to what the law is and has been for 200 years in this country, and with respect to insurrections. So, it's just another reason and another illustration of how wrong the left is, how dangerous to our institutions and to the rule of law the left is. And that's just one illustration. We could sit here all night and talk for hours about other ways that the institutions and the rule of law and our form of government is being undermined by this type of leftist radicalism.
Well, the interesting thing here, and this is what often trips a lot of folks who are conservative in their legal philosophy, it trips them up. I can see that even as a non-lawyer. The left has a perspective of living constitutionalism, wherein the Constitution means whatever they want it to mean. The idea is that it's living and it can adapt to anything they want. So they really don't have much in the way of objective standards when it comes to being right or wrong or this or that, because they're fairly open that the Constitution means what they want it to mean, whereas people on the right have much more in the way of principles about what the Constitution means and, of course, statutes operating under the Constitution. And so a lot of people on the right wind up tripping themselves up with a totally understandable and philosophically consistent view as to what jurisprudence should be. And I am someone who takes a plain meaning approach, which is between the living constitutionalists and the originalists. The originalists are the obviously the most conservative interpreters of the law. The living constitutionalists are out there on the left. The plain meaning folks like me say something has a definition that can be found in a dictionary. Therefore, it should be that. So that's, you know, obviously, once again, I'm a non-lawyer, but that's my take on how the law should be treated in society. Now, getting back to conservatives versus progressives here, the originalists who try to look into what the founders believed and they try to apply what they believed the founders thought to the law in order to make the law as stable as possible are doing what they're doing for the right reason. Even if I disagree with some of their actions, they're doing it for the right reason. People who have the left-wing approach, on the other hand, they're straight out taking statutes and constitutional articles and say, it means one thing today, it means another thing tomorrow, you don't like it, go F yourself. And that's basically it in a nutshell. There's not much more to say. And in dealing with people like that, particularly within the realm of lawfare, you're automatically at a disadvantage. Even if you take the plain meaning approach, such as I do, where you just look at words and their meanings, as opposed to think about what the founders thought. But even if you just look at the plain meaning, if you're going up against someone who's trying to take action against you because they hate you and they have an evolving interpretation of the law, what you'll find is that something that you perceive as an objective standard that might be helpful, that would be helpful to you if it received the treatment under the law that you think it deserves, that's time-honored, the lefties don't believe in the objective standards at all, in the slightest. So, you know, if they get a judge who's on their side and a jury who's on their side, these people, they use precedent whenever it benefits them. And when it doesn't benefit them, they try to overturn the precedent. That's their game. And that's why they are so focused on stacking the judiciary in their favor, because they're able to basically then have the Constitution mean and laws mean whatever they want at any given time. And anybody who's not on their side at any given time is therefore at a disadvantage, because the law, nebulous as it would become, is used against those who have unfashionable views. And these people who have these unfashionable views have minimal recourse, because the law is this ever-changing thing that they can't grapple onto in order to formulate a defense. So it's a very serious, very scary situation.
Yeah, I consider myself to be, with respect to constitutional law, an originalist. But just to back up on that and what that means is, when interpreting the Constitution, when obviously any written law is interpreted in accordance with the meaning of the words. And you only get into interpretation questions and issues when there's ambiguity. And an originalist is going to interpret an ambiguity in the Constitution or the meaning of the Constitution in accordance with the original intent of the framers who drafted the Constitution. And the interesting part, you're exactly right that the left, that they don't care what the original purpose and the original intent behind the Constitution was. They want to interpret the provisions of the Constitution to mean whatever they wanted it to mean. And really, that's the distinction. But ironically, that whether you're talking about constitutional interpretation or statutory interpretation, an original intent or an originalist with respect to constitutional interpretation and a liberal with respect to constitutional interpretation, apply the same standard to statutory interpretation. So the first thing you look when you're looking at a statute, if there's ambiguity, is what was the legislative intent? Even the left believes that. They just want to jettison legislative intent when we examine the founding document, the Constitution. And so it's just really, it's intellectually dishonest, in my opinion, the way lefties want to interpret the Constitution. They do have a penchant to ignore statutory language and ignore legislative intent with respect to statutes as well, but only whenever they have to. You know, so at the end of the day, if the left's belief system about how the Constitution should be interpreted were to prevail, then the Constitution would literally have no meaning, except for what the lefties said it did at that moment. And as you know, that's going to change. In 1996, you take Chuck Schumer and the president then, Bill Clinton, were in favor of the Defense of Marriage Act. 20 years later, or I guess 25 years later, the Defense of Marriage Act, these same people said it was bigotry, that they had supported bigotry 25 years before. So you'd think they would do any different if they were interpreting the Constitution? You know, so it really would have no meaning at all if the leftist view of constitutionalism became the prevailing view.
You know, it's a very interesting matter that you bring up, and I just have to bring this up before we get to your article. By the way, I will say here that Daniel does have a very interesting Substack page. I think that'd be the best way of describing it. And you can find it just by going on to a search engine, typing in Daniel R. Street Substack, and he'll give you the link momentarily. But he does a hell of a lot of great analysis about many different things. And I think it's safe to say that his perspective is absolutely worth your time, regardless of what your political views might be. It's just very sound legal analysis for the rest of us who obviously don't have law degrees, but we still have some inkling of common sense. Now, talking about lefties ignoring the law, the statutory law, whenever it suits them, a perfect example of this is Fannie Willis, because she has been subpoenaed to testify before the Georgia State Senate. And she is saying, no, I do not interpret the law to mean that I have to testify to you. That's testify before your panel under penalty of perjury. I say the law doesn't mean this, so screw you. That's her point of view. And that's a perfect example of lefties just defying the law when they have the authority to, because obviously she's the prosecutor for Atlanta, Fulton County, to be precise. And that's where the state capitol is, although, of course, the state attorney general oversees her. But I would probably take quite a bit of time before the case made it there, perhaps long enough that the date of the hearing would be surpassed. But her action is just, you know, a sterling example of lefties ignoring statutory law whenever they have the opportunity to, whenever they can get away with it.
Yeah, clearly legislative committees in the state of Georgia have subpoena power. They've subpoenaed witnesses all the time. She's just a witness who's been subpoenaed. So the question will be, what will the powers that be do about her insurrection, shall we say, you know? Because the legislature doesn't enforce the law and the legislature doesn't prosecute violations of the law. So that's a separation of powers issue in Georgia with respect to the Georgia State Constitution. So the question is going to be whether the executive office is there, whether it's the attorney general or the governor or whoever in Georgia who has the prosecuting authority, whether they go and prosecute this particular person. And I don't know that they will or they won't. We'll find out. But just as a practical matter, people who are charged with enforcing the law and prosecuting violations of the law should follow the law. And Fannie Willis or Fannie Willis or however you pronounce her name, if she's subpoenaed to appear anywhere, she should go or do like anyone else would do, which would go to court to what we call quash or stop the subpoena and have the court say, you don't have to honor that. So that's the appropriate way for a lawyer in particular, particularly a lawyer who's charged with prosecuting others who violate the law. That's how they should conduct themselves. But look, if you followed that case at all, and I'm talking about the Fulton County Georgia prosecution of President Trump and the other Republicans there, you'll know that that office, the Fulton County DA's office, Mrs. Willis's office, doesn't care about the law. So her flaunting a subpoena is no surprise.
And I just have to ask this, we're on the subject. Obviously, the Court of Appeal in Georgia, which is their, you know, that's their circuit court, which is an interesting thing coming from Florida, because here, as I mentioned to Daniel before we went on, the circuit court would have heard this initially, but in Georgia, it's at the county level, really, from by Floridian standards, crazy, but whatever. The fact of the matter is that the Circuit Court of Appeal is going to hear Trump's motion to, or it has agreed to hear a trust motion. Obviously, his lawyer has to then file the motion for the appellate court to hear it. Yeah. But they've said they would hear it. And the motion is to get Fannie Willis off the case, to bar her from prosecuting Trump, which would also disqualify the entire Fulton County District Attorney's Office. And that is something, you know, of indescribably great consequence for this case, because if Fannie is ousted from the case, it's profoundly unlikely that any other district attorney in the state would take it on and would have to go to a counsel in Georgia that would refer the case to someone else. And that would almost certainly take over a year just to get the referral. And it's just the crazy state of affairs. So I think that the fact that the appellate court, the circuit court, decided to hear the case is substantial, because it's such a momentous case. Number one, it's a crappy case. The rationale for it is absolutely absurd. But in terms of its consequences, it certainly is monumental. And them taking the case means that it's very likely the case will be stayed in county court, district court, by other standards. Therefore, Trump would effectively walk on this, because, you know, like I said, no one other than Fannie Willis almost certainly be willing to bring the case. If she's disqualified, it winds up being the end. So it's interesting that this case is going before the appellate court. I'm not surprised that it is. I think it's a very good omen for Trump that the case was accepted. I do expect the district or the county court a case to be stayed by the district court, by the circuit court, the appellate court. In my mind, once again, circuit court and district court in Florida, the same thing, but different in Georgia. So it's really interesting how this has gone. She's handled the case terribly. She's basically the poster child for a malicious prosecutor, and just terrible, terrible workplace standards, to the point that there really arguably were no standards in her office. So this is definitely big news. Daniel, I'd be very glad to get your thoughts on the matter.
Well, I tell you, you encapsulated the situation very well. And I say that, I think every time I come on, you have a lawyer's understanding, actually, of the situation. The simple fact of the matter is that the defendants had to go when the trial judge ruled not or against disqualifying the Fulton County DA's office, the defendants had to ask the trial judge for permission to immediately try to appeal this interlocutory or non-case ending decision to the Court of Appeal. And then the Court of Appeal had to agree. So the trial court said, yeah, you can go ahead and appeal this. Then the Court of Appeal had to agree that they wanted to hear it. So that's a lot of hoops to jump through to get this question before the higher court. And that you're absolutely right that the higher court agreeing to hear it is a good omen for everyone other than the Fulton County DA's office. And the simple fact is that the trial judge, if you go back to his decision, the trial judge found that there were disqualifying issues with the DA's office that he thought could be cured by disqualifying and removing the special prosecutor, which was Wade. Now, how in the world there's disqualifying issues with the office, how that's solved by removing the guy who was being greased, and not the person greasing the guy, doesn't make any sense. So, and what I mean there is the issue was that Willis had appointed her lover to be the special prosecutor. And then the two of them took all these trips together that the man paid for, the special counsel who's been given the special contract, who's making hundreds of thousands of dollars off of it, is paying for these trips that he and his girlfriend, who happens to be the district attorney, took together. And how do you cure that disqualifying issue by getting rid of the guy who was being paid the money, but not the person who was paying it and benefiting from it, the other person? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So the overwhelming likelihood is that, in my opinion, that Willis and her entire office are going to be removed from that case. It will have to go to that independent commission that you talked about, be reassigned to another DA who anybody with the brain in the district attorney's office anywhere in the state of Georgia where this steaming pile of dung lands is going to wash their hands of it. So removing Willis is going to essentially, in my opinion, kill that illegitimate prosecution. And it can't happen fast enough.
And I have to say, a lot of people are talking, justifiably talking about Fannie Willis eventually getting prosecuted for some of the obviously illegal things she's up to with Nathan Wade, things that will now be relitigated before a higher court. And it's they really believe that she's going to be sent to jail eventually. I do think there's a good chance she'll wind up being prosecuted. I don't think that the state wants a prosecutor, but I think that'll become so apparent, so ridiculously apparent that they will. If she had just stepped down from the damn case, which even many people on the left who initially supported her wanted her to do once this became so crazy, if she just stepped down from the case and shut up, then she probably never stood any risk, no matter how egregious her actions were, of facing prosecution. But I think that this will drag on in such a way before the appellate court oversaw, because it's going to take several months, that there's a good chance the Attorney General's office in Georgia will just say, well, now something has to be done. And because, you know, the Attorney General's an elected official, he's a Republican, I think there will be so much presented to disqualify Willis that Republicans in Georgia will demand her being prosecuted for it. Even if she is prosecuted, it would be in Atlanta. And I posted a video today of her going out there talking about being a Black woman, and that now with Black justice, it's better than white justice. And it's really, you know, needling stuff that's designed to be provocative. And it serves a purpose, because even though she's very arrogant, very headstrong, not particularly intelligent in my view, but she's not stupid. She is a political animal, and she understands how bad this could be for her, clearly. And I think she's shoring up her base to deal with whatever comes. And if the day comes that she is prosecuted for what she's done, criminally prosecuted, not civilly, then I think she imagines, well, I'm here with my my homies, so to speak, in Atlanta, and they support me, because I support them, even though I'm really not doing anything for them, but there's this veneer of support. And so she thinks that if she's ever brought before a jury, that the jury won't convict her. And I think there's a very good chance of that, by the way. I don't think she's wrong in that calculation. So I sort of try to temper expectations that a lot of people have that there will be justice. Fannie will be brought before a court for perjury, for conspiracy, this, that, the other thing. It might happen. But an Atlanta jury was chosen to go after Trump for a reason. And that same jury would not go after Fannie Willis, very possibly, dare I say, probably, for much the same reason. And this goes to show the importance of jury pools. There's a reason why prosecutors wanted to try Trump in D.C., Atlanta, and Manhattan. And they only tried him in Florida because they had no choice there. But, you know, the jury pool matters. And I think Fannie Willis might have a get out of jail free card because of the demographics of the area that she allegedly serves.
Well, you may be right, but when she testified, if you recall during the disqualification hearing, she actually testified that she reimbursed Wade with money that she'd raised during her campaign for the DA's office. That was her testimony under oath. That a couple of weeks later, when the attorney for, I forget which defendant, that the attorney that filed the original disqualification motion went and testified in front of a state Senate committee, the committee members were asking her about that and say, look, that's a clear criminal violation of our campaign finance law. You can't use campaign funds that people have donated to you for your personal benefit, which is exactly what she testified to. The only reason she did that, not to mention the fact it was cash too. So, you know, I can tell you, I don't know what other issues she's being investigated for. I know that she's being investigated for, let me back up. She's being investigated for allegedly potentially misappropriating and misusing some COVID funds. She's being investigated for a couple of other financial issues by the legislature. But beyond that, that's all I've heard about. Anything else she may or may not have done, I don't know. But the campaign finance violations that she voluntarily testified to in open court are enough to land most people in prison. So, you know, maybe you might be right. Obviously, the jury pool is very, very important. And Fulton County, Georgia is overwhelmingly Black. It's overwhelmingly Democrats. But I tell you what, Fulton County juries put Black folks in prison all the time. And whether they're going to put her in there or not, you know, I don't know if she even gets indicted for any of this. But I can tell you that it would be very easy. You've heard the old maxim that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. If the representations made in the Georgia State Senate hearing about campaign finance law, which is the same here, by the way, in Louisiana, you can't just go get cash out of your campaign funds that people have donated to you and go take a trip to the beach. That's what she testified to. You know, that's going to be a tough one to get around, no matter who your jury is. So the question is going to be is whether they prosecute her, and you know, the jury's still out on that, so to speak, because that offense is indictable right now based on her own testimony.
And of course, if she might say, "Well, it's not true," then she would have committed perjury. So sure. It's definitely a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing for her. Dana, one last thing about Fannie before we move along. What do you think more than anything else warrants her disqualification from prosecuting Donald Trump?
Well, without any doubt, the testimony both of Wade and her own testimony, plus the documentary evidence demonstrates that she put her boyfriend in this position, overpaid him, by the way, his hourly rate's higher than a couple of the other contractors they're using who had more experience. So she took the less experienced guy, put him in charge of the prosecution, overpaid him and paid him more comparing to the more experienced prosecutors, then poured the cash to him, and then went on trips that he paid for. All right. So that is, all of those things are disqualifying. All of those things create conflicts because now she's given her lover and herself a financial interest in the prosecution itself. And that is absolutely, positively impermissible. She should not be allowed on the case. And quite frankly, I would be shocked if that activity didn't violate some criminal laws in Georgia. So that's the primary reason why she shouldn't be on the case. She shouldn't be allowed to profit from the prosecution itself.
One interesting thing about Georgia, as I've learned, is that its laws are much broader and much more severe, generally speaking, than what one finds in Florida. So a woman like Fannie Willis, who throws the book at people she dislikes, very easily could have the book thrown back at her. I guess she's not thinking about that when she's going after people, because she imagines she's the person who goes after others. But, you know, the tables can turn very quickly in politics. And at the end of the day, she is a politician. So that definitely is that. What goes around does tend to come around. And I'll just leave that one there. Now, getting to Daniel's article, which it was posted, like I said, on Substack. Daniel, why don't you tell the folks where they can find your Substack page? I described it a bit, but if you'd like to go into greater detail, and please tell them about, by the way, the books you've written.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So Substack's just a blog. And it's Substack.com. If you go to Substack.com and you type in my name, Daniel R. Street, or the name of my Substack blog, which is Fake News Exposed, either one of those, you'll find it. It's free. You can follow for free. You can also go to my website, DanielRStreet.com. So at DanielRStreet.com, there's links to my Substack, which is free. You can get a free digital or audio version of my newest book at my website. And there's links to my social media. There's links to everything True Social to X or Twitter, and there's links to my books at Amazon. So Daniel R. Street, well, you can go and get up to speed on everything I'm doing from the website.
Great. And you have written books about fake news.
That's right. Yeah, all of my books, as a matter of fact, are about fake news. And I've got a 3-book volume about fake news about Trump. that rebukes, refutes, repudiates, however you want to word it, 83 separate propaganda pieces of misinformation and biased attacks on President Trump and his administration, his family. And my most recent book, it goes beyond Trump. There are a couple of chapters, several chapters about Trump, but there are about 10 or 12 chapters about COVID misinformation. There's a couple of chapters about your governor. If you remember the Don't Say Gay misinformation and fake news attacks, the Martha's Vineyard flights and all the misinformation about that. And I cover immigration and gun control and some other things in the more recent book. So that book came out last fall, maybe last November. And it just kind of went beyond the Trump world. But there are a few chapters about Trump in there because there's so much misinformation about Trump. If you're going to write about misinformation, you have to include some of it.
Say the least. Now, getting to the opposite of misinformation, your article is titled Presidential Immunity, the Supreme Court and Trump. Some of the reasons why the Supreme Court will recognize presidential immunity. And it was published on the 8th of May, obviously, this year. If you want to type in Daniel's Substack page, it's danielrstreet.substack.com. Now, as far as the article goes, and a version of it did run at American Greatness on the 5th of April. I'll start from the top. The political indictment of President Trump by special counsel Jack Smith finally worked its way to the United States Supreme Court. I previously outlined the ridiculous indictment and the nature of the preposterous charges made against President Trump for those in need of more background. The case is before the court on President Trump's effort to dismiss the indictment on presidential immunity grounds. Essentially, President Trump argues he is criminally charged for his official acts as president, and due to presidential immunity, he cannot be charged for those actions. The presidential immunity issue will impact at least three of the four criminal cases against President Trump, including the D.C. indictment, the Georgia RICO indictment, and the Florida documents indictment. Obviously, much is riding on the Supreme Court's decision. How might the court rule, and has the court tipped its hand in any way? The answers may surprise you. First, take a closer look at how the Supreme Court framed the question for the parties to address on the presidential immunity issue. The court instructed the parties to answer, quote, the following question, whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office without expressing a view on the merits, end quote. Now, Daniel, please explain why that's so important.
Well, the reason for that is most of the time on the motion to dismiss an indictment, the allegations of the indictment itself are assumed to be true. So when a court looks at a motion to dismiss and the party's been charged with a crime, they file a motion to dismiss, judge, you got to dismiss this indictment. The court says, okay, we're going to look at your issue, but we're going to assume that all of the facts alleged in the indictment are true. And as you can imagine, that really limits a criminal defendant's opportunity to get relief because the government may or may not be able to prove all of those things, but in reviewing a motion to dismiss, ordinarily they don't have to prove anything. The courts just say, we're going to assume all that's true and then see if you get any relief, Mr. Defendant. Well, what's important about that is the way the Supreme Court posed this question, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts? The indictment doesn't allege that the president undertook any official acts at all. Now, as I covered in the previous Substack post, this particular indictment is atrocious. It's what we call a speaking indictment. An indictment is supposed to be a short, concise statement of the relevant facts and the charges. And this indictment reads like it was drafted by the Democrat National Committee. It's a political document, much less than a criminal document, in my opinion. But the prosecution didn't say the president did all of these official acts. You know, the prosecution couched everything to make it look as unofficial as possible. So the simple fact that the court has said, hey, these are alleged to involve official acts, That allegation's by President Trump. So that tells us that there's the potential here for the court, in the way, since they framed the question presented this way, to not assume the facts of the indictment are true. And if that's the case, then that opens up a lot of opportunities for the case to be challenged. And so that's the first tip. I think anybody that looks at how the question was phrased by the court has to say, hey, wait a minute. This really calls into question whether the court's going to take the government to task or not. And so that was like the first hat tip as to what the Supreme Court's going to do.
Obviously, whatever the Supreme Court does is going to be hugely consequential. That's, you know, arguably an understatement. Skipping down a bit, at oral argument, the special counsel admits immunity exists. At oral argument, special counsel admits immunity exists. Importantly, the attorney who presented the oral argument before the Supreme Court on behalf of the special counsel and U.S. Department of Justice admitted some actions of the president are not subject to prosecution. The oral argument itself may be listened to here, or the transcript may be read here. Obviously, your article people can get the interesting stuff. Justice Gorsuch asked the special counsel, quote, did you agree that there are some core functions of the executive that a president conduct that Congress cannot criminalize? The prosecution responded, yes, we, and then Gorsuch said, so is that a form? I mean, we can call it immunity, or you can call it they can't do it, but what's the difference? The prosecution said, we call it an as-applied Article 2 challenge that we think. Gorsuch said, okay. The prosecution said, fits within. Then Gorsuch said, can we call it immunity just for shorthand's sake? So I think we are kind of narrowing the ground of dispute here. It seems to me there is some area you concede that on official acts that Congress cannot criminalize. I'll end quoting him there. As you say, Daniel, even the special counsel prosecuting Trump in this ridiculous political indictment agreed that some presidential actions may not be subjected to indictment. The special counsel did not want to call this immunity, but rather an applied Article 2 challenge. It claims it should be limited to core presidential acts, but this was a massive concession. Notice how Justice Gorsuch says, quote, we are narrowing the ground of dispute here, end quote. The reason he said that is the prosecutor just admitted the president does have some form of immunity for some acts. So the Supreme Court is not being asked to make up immunity that does not exist, but rather to ascertain the parameters of an immunity the government agrees exists. I'll stop reading there. Daniel, obviously that's a major thing. I think one may argue it's the linchpin of your article, but of course you may disagree. Anything to say about it?
Yeah, I was really surprised to hear the special counsel, Mr. Drieben's his name, to hear that concession be made. Now, the reason that's so critical is the district court and the court of appeal held a president has no immunity at all whatsoever. The court of appeal said that once a president, in this case, President Trump, once he leaves office, he's like anybody else. The special counsel just admitted to the United States Supreme Court, that's not correct. All right. So the only real question then becomes not is there immunity for the president, whether you want to call it immunity or not. The only reason they don't want to call it immunity is because they're trying not to concede that particular piece of turf. But not whether there are things for which a president cannot be criminally prosecuted. The question isn't whether there is or isn't. The question is whether these things that are being charged fall within that immunity or not. And so that's a tremendous concession that really, think about it, if you're on the Supreme Court, and you wanted to say there's no immunity at all of any kind. How do you do that after the special counsel who's prosecuting the case just said, oh, they agree there's some things that you can't prosecute the president for. So now you just had the rug pulled out from under you if you're one of those members of the court who did not want to recognize immunity. So that was huge. And it was a really, really good moment. And you saw Justice Gorsuch say, I think his exact words, I think we're kind of narrowing the ground of dispute. And that's what he's talking about. We're not talking about whether there is any immunity at all. We're talking about how extensive it is. And so that was a good moment for the president.
Obviously, it was. Even a guy like me could see that. Getting back to the article, the next section is titled Politically Driven Prosecution Violates the Constitution. The special counsel made another startling admission in the argument before the Supreme Court. He stated, quote, evidence, a politically driven prosecution would violate the Constitution under Waite versus United States, end quote. Daniel said, I could not agree more. This politically driven prosecution should be dismissed immediately and the lawless rogues pursuing it brought to justice. What is astounding to me, this blatantly political horse manure of a prosecution is being passed off as a legitimate exercise of federal police power by the Biden regime and its special counsel. What a shameful display. I'll stop reading there. It is a shameful display indeed, from my point of view. I would hope from the point of view of most people, because this is so obviously partisan. And I guess I just have to say quickly, some say, no, it's not partisan, it's nonpartisan. In order to explain that away, you'd have to rationalize why it is that the man who defeated Trump, who's obviously a member of the opposing political party to Trump, would appoint an attorney general, an explicitly political appointee, who would then appoint Jack Smith, his wife's politics almost certainly are a very good approximation of his own, and she made a documentary about Michelle Obama. So this happens, and then Trump winds up getting prosecuted in arguably the most unfavorable jurisdiction for any Republican in the country, Washington, D.C., which I think gave him 8% of the vote. And then, of course, they tried to bring the Florida prosecution, D.C. as well, but that went haywire. So it's political. It's obviously political. The indictments were not brought until after Trump announced he was running against Joe Biden. How much more political can it possibly get? And obviously, the trials were intended to take place during the primary campaign season and the general election, although I think it was hoped for that Trump would be deemed so unpopular he would not make it through the primary. So it's political. It simply is political, no two ways about it. And a politically driven prosecution, obviously violating the Constitution, would seem to be something that Trump could use as means of getting his case dismissed. But that's just my point of view. Daniel, anything to say about what you wrote or my commentary on it?
Yeah, I think that the best proof of the political nature of this prosecution is the indictment itself and the charges. Two of the charges are the obstruction of official proceedings. That's 18 U.S.C. 1512. I know we've talked about this in the past. I've got a Substack about that as well. So I won't beat that horse too much, except to say that that whether or not that particular statute's actually two provisions of that statute can be used in this context is already at the Supreme Court. It had never been used in this context ever before. There were statutes that were passed because of the Enron scandal and because of destruction of evidence and tampering with evidence during a congressional investigation. So that's what the statutes are for. So this was a political misuse of these particular statutes. Then the other two statutes that President Trump is charged with violating, one of them is the conspiracy against rights, which is one of the provisions that was used to prosecute the Klan whenever the Klan would suppress people's right to vote. Then it even talks about riding in disguise on the highway. And then the other is, and the other statute is conspiracy against the United States, which is usually used to prosecute tax cheats. And there's not even any monetary deprivation involved in this case. So there, in fact, no deprivation of any kind involved in the case. So the entire indictment itself, if you didn't know anything about the context of it and you just read it, it's political. It's not a legitimate criminal indictment. It's a political one. And that's why when I heard this guy in oral argument say, a politically driven prosecution would violate the Constitution. I was hoping that one of the justices would come back. Well, then shouldn't we dismiss this one right now? That ought to be it. Nobody did that because they all have to pretend like everything's shrouded in this professionalism, no matter how illegitimate it is. And so, but nevertheless, make no mistake, this is a political indictment. All of the indictments of President Trump are political. They're blatantly political. And the contention that they're anything other than political lacks credibility.
And there are other sections of your article I'll get to here a bit more briefly, but one of them is the other branches of the federal government enjoy some immunity. Daniel, explain why that is important relative to Donald Trump's situation.
Well, the federal government under the Constitution is broken into three branches. There's the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. The legislative branch is covered by Article 1 of the United States Constitution. The executive branch is covered by Article 2 of the United States Constitution, and the judicial branch is covered by Article 3. So in other contexts, Article 1 officers, which are senators and House members, and in Article 3 officers, which are the judiciary, have some form of this immunity. They have immunity for official acts. It's based in the Constitution. So the notion that the president, who has infinitely more authority, by the way, because it's Congress passes the law, the president and the executive branch enforce the law, and the judiciary just rules on disputes and interprets the law. So the presidency and the executive branch literally implements all of the law, and then they develop all the regulations. So the vast overwhelming majority of the actual federal government, the federal government's actual work and the reach that the federal government has on a daily basis is the executive branch. When you go down to the IRS, that's an executive office. When you go to the federal courthouse, that's actually an executive office. It's just occupied by Article 3 officers. Whenever you deal with the Social Security Administration, that's an executive office. With the military, those are all executive offices. They're under the command and control of the chief executive. So why the person who has the most authority and the most opportunity to get himself in trouble, so to speak, and to develop political enmity, why that person, and now I'm talking about the president, why that person would have no immunity when Congress people have some and judges under Article 3 have some, it's just ludicrous. It doesn't make any sense. And the president needs the immunity more than anybody. And that's why the Supreme Court ruled that in Nixon versus Fitzgerald, that presidents have absolute immunity from being sued for anything they do in office. So as you can see, that same rationale applies very easily to the criminal context.
I think something needs to be noted here before we move on to the last few segments of your article. The Supreme Court has already ruled that the president has immunity for official acts and for acts on the outer perimeter of officialdom. Exactly what that means is up for any district court to decide, and then it works its way on up the grapevine. But the fact of the matter is that the Supreme Court, having already decided the president has civil immunity, and they set a parameters for this, however vague the officialdom aspect might, the peripheral aspect of officialdom might be, it does not follow that there would be no criminal immunity. Because if you're immune civilly, why would you not be immune criminally? It would seem to defeat the purpose, because certainly a president being bogged down by lawsuits would also be bogged down by criminal cases. So the notion that the president has no argument for criminal immunity, one would have to square that with the president having been granted civil immunity by, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court. So I find these arguments, I've always found these arguments that Trump has no case, no prayer, nothing when it comes to immunity. The arguments I always found to be absolutely absurd, because all that would need be done is building on the logic of the Supreme Court's prior decision from 1982 about civil immunity. Daniel, anything to say about that before we move along?
No, I agree with you completely. And the rationale, that's why I said the rationale behind Nixon versus Fitzgerald, which is lawsuits would hamstring the president. The president would always be worried about lawsuits. He would be subject to being inundated with lawsuits. Lawsuits could be used to influence policy. All of those concerns that the court used to create that immunity exist in this context as well. And it's important that prior to Nixon versus Fitzgerald, no federal court had recognized absolute immunity from civil liability for a president. No court had ever recognized that. Nixon versus Fitzgerald was the first to do so. And I think the Supreme Court's going to do the same thing in the criminal context now.
And getting back to your article, the next segment is the failure of Congress to apply criminal laws to the president. That is important for obvious reasons, because Congress does write the federal criminal statutes. So if none have been applied to none have been written for the president as of yet, it would seem to be that the implication is, well, the president can't be criminally prosecuted. That's why none of these laws were ever written. Daniel, anything to say about what you wrote?
Yeah, this is really just a simple legal principle, and it's called the clear statement. The Congress, if Congress wants to try to burden the president, the law is very clear that Congress has to make a clear statement that they're trying to ensnare the president in their statute. And that's why, for instance, if you go to federal court and you want to enjoin the federal government, which means you want to get a court to order that a federal government has to stop doing something, you want to get injunctive relief, you do not sue the president, because you can't, because the United States Supreme Court has ruled, and it's cited in my article about Marbury versus Madison, that the official acts of the president, quote, can never be examinable by the courts. So the courts can't order the president to do or not do anything. That's why you have to sue agency heads and departments and all of this business. Okay, it's because of that and that rule. Well, here we've got it. That's why the president of the United States is not subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, because Congress didn't say explicitly they wanted the APA to apply to the president. I cited that in my article. None of the criminal statutes that we're talking about here explicitly say that they apply to the president. The Supreme Court could very easily say, hey, these statutes don't apply to the president because Congress didn't say they did. And that would be the end of that. Now, I don't think there's a majority of the court that's going to rule that way. And actually, another issue that I didn't put in my article was the president's legal team did not raise the clear statement issue in the district court. They raised it in a reply brief in the court of appeal. But at oral argument, the government's lawyer, Dreeben, gave the court permission, if you will. I mean, he doesn't really give the court permission, but he said it was okay, if you will, to the government if the court reached the clear statement issue. He said, well, there's two or three ways the court could get to consider the clear statement rule issues. So that was another concession that was unnecessary, really, for the special counsel to make. But I expect that to weigh into the decision. I don't expect that to be the deciding factor.
It's a tangled web, to say the absolute least, but one worth untangling, learning about. It influences all of us, the outcome of this immunity case. Then the next thing you bring up, this is the second to last segment of the article, is the impeachment judgment clause. That is something which one does not hear much about when it comes to Trump and this immunity issue. Daniel, please explain the significance of it.
Sure. The impeachment judgment clause in the Constitution says that if a president is impeached and convicted on the impeachment articles, then he is subject to additional punishment, indictment. The exact language is he may face indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment if convicted on the articles. The problem they have here is that you'll recall President Trump, all of this January 6th business happened right at the end of his term. So after President Trump was gone, the Democrats still controlled the United States House at that time. The House impeached President Trump for the second time. Now, people forget about the first impeachment. It was just utterly ridiculous. That's the one about the phone call with Zelensky, the Ukrainian president. The second impeachment largely tracks the January 6th indictment. So it was over a lot of the same conduct. And in fact, some of the same arguments, some of the arguments were made for the first time. Arguments that are included in the indictment were made for the first time in the second impeachment. The problem is President Trump was acquitted on the second impeachment. He wasn't convicted. So the implication when the impeachment judgment clause says if the president's convicted on the articles of impeachment, he may face punishment, indictment, prosecution. Then if he's acquitted, what it doesn't say, but what's an implication is if he's acquitted on those charges, he's not subject to indictment, punishment, and prosecution. So that's the impeachment judgment clause argument. It's basically a double jeopardy argument that he was already tried for supposedly high crimes and misdemeanors and acquitted, and you can't charge him again.
And the final segment of your article is titled, and this is something interesting because obviously the trial court is not favorable to Donald Trump, but all the same, it still winds up being good for him, particularly considering the timing, the amount of time all this is taking. But the last segment is titled, Remand to the Trial Court is Likely. Now, Daniel, please explain why that's so important and what the consequences of it are probable to be for Donald Trump.
Well, the reason for it is I believe that the Supreme Court's going to recognize presidential immunity, but presidents won't have immunity for everything. President Trump's legal team concedes that any president has no immunity for private acts. So, you know, if the president, rob somebody or something, you know, that would be a private act. Didn't have anything to do with his office. So it's not an official act. But the Supreme Court, I expect the Supreme Court to rule that the president has immunity for his official acts. And those official acts will cover, similar to Nixon versus Fitzgerald on the absolute immunity for civil lawsuits for the president, the outer perimeter of the president's official acts. So there's core acts. There's core things the president does, command the military, appoint people to office, those sorts of things. And then there are things that are at beyond that. And eventually those things that the president does fade into things that become private. The court's going to have to fashion a test and tell the lower court, okay, now here's the test. It is probably going to be something along the lines of Nixon versus Fitzgerald about the outer perimeter and the core functions and official acts. Send it back to the district court and say, we want you to conduct an evidentiary hearing and scrutinize the facts in this indictment. Once again, not take them as true, but present evidence and to have evidence taken and testimony presented about the decisions of the president that are being subject to review here and decide which ones fall within the immunity and which ones don't. And then the court's going to have to decide what happens to the conduct that's subject to immunity. I expect the court to order that it has to be expunged, what we call expunged, which is removed from the indictment completely. So those are all the things that have to be decided. It will require, in my opinion, an evidentiary record. And let me say for full disclosure purposes here, I'm not the person that originally came up with this. I heard a very influential, erudite, intelligent lawyer named William Shipley, who was a U.S. attorney, and he's defended about 50 January 6th defendants, cover this first. And I just went and researched it some more, and I think he's right. I think that's how it's going to break down, because that's what happens in any other immunity. If a federal agent is charged with murder and he's raising qualified immunity, the court typically holds a hearing to determine, okay, what was the agent doing? Does qualified immunity apply? And if it does, the charges get dismissed. You know, so that is what should happen here.
We shall see what does happen. I think it's very likely to go well for Trump, the immunity argument. I'm sure they will hold he has immunity criminally, much as he does civilly, the Supreme Court being they. And a lot of heads will explode as a result of it, which no doubt will be entertaining. Now, Daniel, unfortunately, as we do begin to wind things down, I do have to ask, I mean, Would you ever consider becoming, if the opportunity presented itself, a federal judge? Because, I mean, quite obviously, you have the mind and the temperament for it. A lot of prosecutors become judges, which can produce a lot of problems. But to see a trial lawyer become a judge, particularly one who is a Republican, which is definitely a break from the norm, would you take that opportunity that came to you? Because I certainly think that your keen legal analyses could be put to good use for the American public, especially in Louisiana, where you are.
Well, I thank you very kindly. I always tell you, you're a very kind and gracious man. no, there is not a circumstance under which I would be a federal judge. Now, let me say this. That doesn't matter anyway, because nobody's ever going to nominate me in the first place. But I got to tell you, I would not want to be a judge. And there's a lot of reasons for it. That is, being a federal judge is one of the best judge jobs in the world. The pay is good. The work hours are good. The retirement's good. The health insurance is good. All of those things, you know, your furnishings and your office and your courtroom and everything are top notch and, you know, always in good working order and all those sorts of things. So, which, believe it or not, is not the case in state courts a lot of times. So those are great judge jobs, if you will. I just have no interest in being a judge. And I thank you very kindly for the compliment. But being a judge is a difficult job. And what people don't realize is, even though I'm like anybody else, I would love to be a judge to get to rule on this. Or I'd love to be the judge on Trump's New York prosecution, because I would have tossed it in immediately. And but these judges have the day-to-day stuff that they do, the federal judges, the vast majority of it is federal criminal prosecutions, usually drug-related, and just a lot of tediousness, a lot of rules, the Paperwork Reduction Act, which oddly enough triples the amount of paperwork you have to do. It's amazing to me we get as many qualified and good people that want to do the job. So I thank you, but no thanks.
No, I understand entirely. It's definitely not for everyone. It would not be for me, even though, you know, it's an immensely valuable thing to do. I'm not knocking it to any degree. But, of course, the problem is that a lot of people accept the job. Many people accept the job, do so with the greatest of intentions. But then there are a lot of partisan activists, ideologues who worm their way in, and that presents a slew of problems, as we now see, not just at the federal level, but at the state level. At the state level, much more so, actually, because a lot of these are elected offices, such as Merchant. He's a Democrat who has to face the Manhattan Democratic electorate. If they don't like the way he treats Trump, they can boot him out and replace him with somebody else. So he has an incentive, a very perverse incentive, to be as unfair as possible to Trump. And you certainly see, I believe, him responding to that incentive on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And I think that, I believe we talked about this before, but one of the primary problems we have with our federal judiciary, and having said that, let me say this first. There are a lot of wonderful federal judges, and I know several personally. There are some great federal judges, but there are some that are terrible. And the real problem is that both the former presidents, with respect to our current president included, with respect to who they nominate, and the United States Senate with respect to who they confirm, have dropped the ball. And the simple fact is that in far too many cases, people are put on the federal bench who are not jurists. They're not statesmanlike. They're activists. They're political activists. There's several really, really terrible illustrations of that in the D.C. district. I think the judge that's on this case in the district is a good illustration of that. Judge Burl Howell, who was the senior judge for a while. She's not senior anymore, I don't believe. But she was literally a political activist. It would be the equivalent of putting a Republican lobbyist on the bench, you know. And when that happens, what you get is the type of abuse of process and abuse of the law that's going on in the D.C. district with respect to January 6th defendants and this prosecution. And so I think in the future, what I would hope to see is the United States Senate be a lot more hands-on about who they confirm and not just rubber stamp anybody that the ABA puts their stamp of approval on, and have presidents be more judicious, if you will, in the appointments that they make.
And, you know, just for a bit of, I guess, illustration here as we depart, Judge Chukan, Tanya Chukan, she was an Obama activist and donor who had been an opponent of the Republican Party. I've read her statements going back to the 1980s when she believed the Ronald Reagan administration was too racist. And she was a very recent immigrant here at the time. So, I mean, the woman definitely has a perspective that is political. And she even became a much more strict judge when it comes to sentencing when the J6 cases made their way to her courtroom. So, I mean, there's no question it's the politicization of the D.C. circuit. Unfortunately, it spreads to other places. But it is a real thing. And the mindset, I believe, today, the Democratic side, is such that if Fannie Willis were nominated for a federal judgeship, whether it's a district court judgeship or an appellate judgeship, she could be on video taking money out of her campaign account and burning it, and then consorting with a bunch of male strippers, and she could post the video to YouTube, and they would still confirm her overwhelmingly, because to them, having an activist who is politically loyal and who is ideologically pure is that important. And when it comes to the Republicans, they definitely have a different mindset when it comes to who they put on the bench.
Yeah, the look, I'm not going to tell anybody there aren't any Republican activists that have made it to the federal judiciary.
Oh, there sure are.
but they're nothing like the Democrat activists. And but at the end of the day, what I would like to see, and let's keep this in mind, people don't realize this: the United States Constitution, Article 3 of the Constitution, gave the federal judiciary the judicial power. But the Constitution only created one court, and that's the United States Supreme Court. All other courts are created by Congress. All right. So the Article 3 of the Constitution says the judicial power lies in the United States Supreme Court and such inferior courts as Congress may provide. All right. So Congress can do whatever it wants with every court except the Supreme Court. And what I would like to see Congress do is to balkanize the D.C. district and bust it into pieces and do the same thing to the D.C. circuit and get that, because these guys just have this little fiefdom, and it's this incredible concentration of judicial power in a very, very tiny area. And I would like to see it just balkanized and spread around the rest of the country and send all those judges to different districts and break it up so they're not victimizing everybody in Washington. And I think that would go a long way to restoring some integrity and some confidence in the federal judiciary in D.C.
Perhaps there's a Republican Congress, Trump will wind up doing that, provided that he is reelected. I mean, as with anything else, we'll have to wait and see. Daniel, for parting words tonight, do you think that the immunity case, if it is decided as you and I anticipate it will be decided, do you think that this will have any real impact on the election? Because obviously the prosecutions have not had much of an impact now, but if Trump is found to be immune, some say that it could lead the public to say, oh, he's guilty and he has to take advantage of the immunity. And so if he were really innocent, he would want to face the music in court. But others say that it's not going to make a big deal. I'm in that camp. And yet more say it might actually wind up helping him, exonerating him in a way. What do you expect? Because in addition to being a lawyer, you've been around in politics for some time. What do you expect the political outcome of this to be?
Well, first of all, I agree. I mean, as I've said several times, that I believe the Supreme Court's going to recognize the immunity. I will say it's not going to be like the Colorado disqualification case, which was unanimous, 9-0. In the president's favor. This is going to be a much closer case. It's either going to be 6-3 or 5-4, in my opinion, based on the oral argument and what I heard and what I know about the justices. But I do believe the court's going to rule in President Trump's favor. And I will say, with respect to politics, you know, Cotto, we talked about this several times. I don't have the political instincts that you have. You are almost always right. And a lot of times I'm disappointed that you're right. But many, many times I'm like, nah, I don't know. I think Kato's wrong about that. And when it comes to like who's going to win and who's going to win a nomination, who's going to win an election. But I will say this. The case going in President Trump's favor on the immunity question will absolutely, positively, without any doubt, be a political positive for President Trump. And there's several reasons for it. One of them is because it will derail at least three of the prosecutions. Even if it doesn't completely derail them, it will derail them from, you know, interfering in the election between now and November. And so part of their plan is to keep President Trump tied up in court like they're doing right now so that he can't campaign and that the news every night is running about what happened in court today. And President Trump flew from this court, then he flew over to that court, and they keep him off the campaign trail and keep all the news be about his court cases. And a favorable opinion from the Supreme Court is going to put an end to all of that. And at the very least, cut it way, way back and put it all past the election. And there's no way that's anything but a positive for President Trump.
Oh, I agree, it'd be a positive. I don't think it would necessarily shift public opinion, but as a practical matter, in terms of physically freeing him up to do what he needs to do to campaign, it'd be a positive. Although I will say, he's basically, you know, the front porch campaign goes back to Warren G. Harding in the 20s. But now Trump is basically doing a front or a courthouse lobby campaign, and his numbers are doing are incredibly well. I mean, he has some unbelievably good data out, like from Washington State, which I would not have expected at all. I don't think he's going to win Washington State, but the fact that he's this competitive is shocking. So these cases are not hurting him at all. They are helping him. But I think the Democrats have gone so far with this now, they can't let up, even if it's doing what it's doing, which is countering their own interests, because it's one of those things, you know, once you start, you can't just stop and turn around. You have to go all the way. That's what LBJ said with regard to the Civil Rights Bill in 1964, when he realized that what he was doing is really going to screw his party over in terms of the white vote. But then he said that his party would have a certain group for 200 years. And I certainly can't repeat what he said, but I can repeat that he said you have to go all the way. Even if it's something that's going to be damaging, because once you start it, sometimes something so massive and so consequential that even if the consequences are negative, you can't stop it because there's just no way to tone down your velocity and go back to where you were before. The situation has changed and you basically try to repeat the past and it's impossible. So I do think that the Democrats see that these cases are helping Trump. They have to see it. That's why you see Biden doing what he's doing with regard to halting certain aid to Israel, because he realizes that he's losing a hell of a lot of support, and he's trying to shore it up. It's a desperate move, but the desperation is born out of the fact that these trials are not working as intended politically. Daniel, final word, anything to say before we move along?
Yeah, the last thing that I try to always end an interview with a positive, something positive. And I truly believe that the masses of people have a tremendous ability to see what the truth is. And I've seen that many times with juries. When you have a jury, you have a really tight case, really difficult case, and really hotly contested case, and a lot of disputed facts. People have a tremendous ability to see what the truth is. Now, look, they can be fooled at times, or they can be not paying attention at times and things like that. But what you see here is an orchestrated effort by multiple governments. You have the federal government, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Manhattan District Attorney, then you've got the Fulton County DA, and you have indictments of Republicans in other jurisdictions. You've got it in Michigan. You've got it. You had it in Wisconsin to a much less degree, Arizona and others. And all of that is being done to try to derail President Trump. And you remember the disqualification cases were filed, I believe, in every state. Uh-huh. You know, and That was to try to stop his candidacy. But what we've seen is that the people who decide elections, for the most part, first is turnout, base turnout, but independents decide who the president is. And the independents aren't buying this. The independents are turning against the Democrats because of it. There's a backlash amongst independents because of all these weaponization of law enforcement. And so I tell people, look, all we have to do is keep shining the light of truth on what's going on here. And enough people are going to see, and they're going to see through the media misinformation and see through the propaganda to see the truth. And they will respond just the way you expect they will. They'll send Donald Trump back to the White House.
I think that is what's likely to take place at this point. And it will definitely be interesting to see what happens over the next several months. We'll have quite a bit to discuss when it comes to the lawfare in this campaign season, because even if Trump has this win, which we both expect at the Supreme Court, there will certainly be twists and turns and all manner of BS that is designed to derail him in one way or another. The Democrats aren't going to stop just because they lose. Even if they think that they're going to lose for sure, it's all the way. Like I said, once they start, they just can't stop. They have to see it through to the end because they really have no alternative. I mean, when I say that in this case, what I mean is that their base would go ape excrement if they just decide to chill out and have a normal campaign season. And then the base wouldn't show up for down ballot races. And the base, which is already angry about the Gaza thing, would be angry for election cycles to come. So, you know, all the way means all the way, even if it's all the way down. So you're going to see a lot more BS, I'm sure of that. I'm sure we'll be discussing it, however unfortunate it might be. But anyway, Daniel, thank you very much for stopping by. Great discussion, as always.
Hey, thank you for having me. And like I said, like you said, that there's no telling how much more we'll have to talk about, and I look forward to it.
Absolutely. I look forward to it as well. And everyone, I hope you got as much out of this conversation as Daniel and I did. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.